Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The leader of the Florida Senate gets the number one thing he wanted out of this year's legislative session, courtesy of the Florida House.
We are doing good work here in the Florida legislature to preserve and protect the major ecological engine in all of South Florida.
Also tonight, the House and Senate are nearing a grand bargain on medical cannabis, but some lawmakers remain unhappy.
You see, there's a Trojan horse stuck in this bill, whether we meant it or not, and that is the chronic non-malignant pain definition.
We'll also learn about drive-by lawsuits, a bill allowing local elected officials to meet away from public scrutiny, and a new permanent law putting Florida foster kids on the highway to freedom. I'm Tom Flanagan. Just 3 days to go in the 2017 Florida lawmaking session. This is Capitol Report. The Florida House has signed off on Senate President Joe Negron's top priority, a water reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee. Len Hatter reports after a quick stop and approval by the Senate, the measure is heading to Governor Rick Scott's desk.
The Florida House has signed off on Senate President Joe Negron's top priority, a water reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee. I'm Len Hatter. At one point, the price tag on the proposal was $2 billion. Then it ballooned to $3 billion as more water projects poured into it. Its current price tag? $1.2 billion. A compromise, says Representative Thad Altman, that's aimed at protecting communities south of Lake Okeechobee from polluted runoff that has shut down beaches, made people sick, and wreaked havoc on the economy.
We are doing good work here in the Florida legislature to preserve and protect the major ecological engine in all of South Florida, from an economic to an environmental to a water quality and source for 6 million people.
The proposal is part of a larger compromise on key priorities that are making a deal on a statewide budget possible. Despite its passage, issues still linger, such as the fact that Negron's main priority has never been vetted by House members, an issue Representative Lori Berman alluded to with this question.
I move to refer SB 10, which was not heard by any House committees, to the House Subcommittee on Agriculture and Property Rights and the House Committee on Appropriations.
Her request was shot down. Negron's bill still aims to build a water storage reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee by using mostly state land. Agricultural workers who lose their jobs would be given preferential hiring to build the reservoir, a response to concerns it will take jobs away from nearby struggling communities. The deal between the chambers allows bonding up to $800 million to finance construction, something House leaders initially refused to do. Here's Republican Representative Holly Rothschild spelling out the deal.
The amendment decreases the authorized bonding amount from $1.2 billion to $800 million. It decreases the annual appropriation from the LATF from $100 million to $64 million beginning in fiscal year 2018-2019 and requires any remaining funds to be made available only for the C-51 reservoir project or other identified Everglades projects.
The LATF is the Land Acquisition Trust Fund, and the reductions clear up more money to be used on other projects, as well as for financing to come from other sources. Not all lawmakers believe the plan is the best way to address water concerns in Central Florida. Democratic Representative Katie Edwards says too often lawmakers have started projects and never finished them.
Our responsibility is to fund it, not to substitute our judgment for the professionals, the scientists, the engineers, the hydrologists that vet these projects.
House members approved the measure 99-18, clearing the way for water projects around Lake Okeechobee to move forward. In a statement, the Florida sugarcane farmers praised the bill for not taking sugar land out of production and choosing to focus on state property instead. Association spokesman Ryan Duffy says it's now time for the legislature to focus on reducing pollution originating north of the lake. And Democrats like Edwards and Representative David Richardson say they'd like to see northern storage considered in the future.
I really believe that we need to have a comprehensive plan. We need to figure out how we can get the water to be less nutrient rich before it comes into the north end of the lake.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
The Florida House is advancing a medical marijuana proposal packed with last-minute changes to bring it closer to the Senate position. Nick Evans reports for some in the House, it's a tough pill to swallow.
Early on, Majority Leader Ray Rodriguez zigged to the right on his medical cannabis proposal, incorporating ideas from marijuana opponents and picking up hardliners in his chamber. But then at the 11th hour, he zagged on him. Here's Venice Republican Representative Julio Gonzalez.
You see, there's a Trojan horse stuck in this bill, whether we meant it or not, and that is the chronic non-malignant pain definition.
Rodriguez is now embracing the Senate position, giving doctors the green light to recommend the drug for pain so long as it's tied to a qualifying condition, like cancer, multiple sclerosis, and the like. Throughout this year's session, the Senate position has been less restrictive, and not just when it comes to pain. Fleming Island Republican Senator Rob Bradley's proposal has fewer requirements for caregivers, no 90-day doctor-patient relationship requirement, and central to the debate, lower thresholds when it comes to adding new growers. But on that last bit, Rodriguez says he struck a deal.
In the bill that you voted on last week, for every 100,000 new patients, we directed DOH to issue 3 new licenses. The Senate wanted 5 new licenses issued for every 75,000 new patients. Where we have compromised is 4 new licenses for every 100,000 patients. So that is what is in the bill.
He explains the House and Senate are still at odds over capping the number of storefronts a license holder can establish. The Senate believes with a limited number of growers, unlimited storefronts could allow early entrants to monopolize the marketplace and inflate prices. But Rodriguez believes more storefronts means more access.
I think from a patient perspective, when they think about access, what's important to them is how close is the storefront. From a patient perspective, when they think about access, what's important to them is how quickly can one of the dispensaries deliver the product to them?
Rodriguez's measure is now on its way to the Senate, and his moderation only cost him the votes of members on the extremes. Stewart Republican Gail Harrell has been outspoken in her opposition to cannabis, but she came on board because she believes a state tracking system will keep physicians from recommending the drug excessively. Across the aisle, though, Orlando Democrat Carlos Guillermo Smith says the bill is still too restrictive when it comes to treating pain. He notes chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD.
So would we rather this person get prescription opioids to handle the pain? Maybe they're chasing those pills down with booze. Who knows? Or would we prefer that they smoke a bowl and go to sleep and actually wake up the next morning?
Senators plan to take up their version of medical cannabis legislation Tuesday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a bill to crack down on the drug fentanyl led to a floor debate on mandatory minimum sentences today.
Minimum mandatories aren't working. They don't work, especially when we talk about individuals with a drug addiction.
The Florida Senate considers cracking down on juveniles considered prolific offenders, backed by supporters like Pinellas Sheriff Bob Galtieri.
These kids are out there with high recidivism, wreaking havoc, committing crimes that are very serious crimes because there's no fear of consequence.
And we'll hear the latest about a program helping Florida's foster kids to take the wheel.
Support for Capital Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
Every day, Floridians die from a drug called fentanyl. It's a synthetic opioid similar to morphine, but much stronger. Lawmakers are working to crack down on its distribution. But along with that discussion on the Senate floor today came a debate about mandatory minimum sentences. Regan McCarthy has more.
Sarasota Republican Senator Greg Stube is behind the bill.
This bill creates criminal penalties for trafficking in fentanyl and synthetic drugs. It allows a person to be charged with murder for causing any death through the distribution of fentanyl, heroin, and any mixture thereof. This penalty currently exists for cocaine, opium, and methadone, but it does not exist for carfentanyl and fentanyl and fentanyl derivatives, which every day are killing people in our state and probably every one of our districts.
As part of that bill, Stube proposed mandatory minimum sentences that would have sent a person with 4 grams of the drug to prison for 3 years by charging them with a first-degree felony for trafficking. But many lawmakers in the chamber pushed back against the plan. Occoee Democratic Senator Randolph Bracey filed an amendment to remove the mandatory minimum sentence provision for fentanyl. It's a move St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis supports. He says often people don't even realize they're buying drugs laced with fentanyl.
They were caught with some other type of drug. They had no clue what was in it. And all of a sudden, with one extra gram, their penalty went from 15 to 25 years, or from 3 to 15 years. Imagine that. Imagine it's your kids. Imagine you standing up there and asking that judge and him saying, "I'm sorry, I can't do anything. Go talk to the prosecutors."
Right now, prosecutors have the flexibility to reduce sentences through a process called downward departure. Brandis says judges should be given that same flexibility. Meanwhile, Hialeah Republican Senator Rene Garcia says Florida needs to reevaluate the way it responds to drug users.
Minimum mandatories aren't working. They don't work, especially when we talk about individuals with a drug addiction. Drug addiction shouldn't be a crime. It's an illness. And unfortunately, in this state and across the country, we're not talking about the underlying issue.
Garcia says that issue is that governments aren't spending enough money to ensure drug addicts get the treatment and care they need to recover. But Ocala Republican Senator Dennis Baxley argues minimum sentences do work.
It's because it's not right that you have disparate sentencing depending on what town you committed the crime in. It should be consistent. And that's the purpose of mandatory minimums. And I would say they sort of do work when you're having a 45-year low in crime.
After a lengthy debate on the House floor Tuesday, Bracey's amendment passed. Senators are expected to take a full floor vote on the measure Wednesday. Lawmakers say they're planning to have a larger discussion surrounding minimum mandatory sentences next legislative session. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
The Florida Senate is considering legislation by Tampa Representative James Grant and Clearwater Senator Jack Latvala that creates a class of prolific juvenile offenders. The measures keep the young offenders in custody for up to 21 days and then release them with electronic monitoring. We get more on that story from Sarah Mueller.
Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Guadalatieri says some kids in the state are committing armed robberies, burglaries, and stealing cars. But courts can only hold them in detention for 3 weeks before trial. And they can only be held for 15 days after being convicted.
These kids are out there with high recidivism, wreaking havoc, committing crimes that are very serious crimes because there's no fear of consequence. And the reason why there's no fear of consequence, quite honestly, is because there is no consequence.
The Tampa Bay Times reports that Pinellas led the state in juvenile grand theft auto arrests in 2015. Legislation by Tampa Representative James Grant creates a class of prolific juvenile offenders. People younger than 18 years old would be considered prolific if they're charged with a crime that would be a felony if they were an adult, or they've committed a felony prior to the current charge, or have been arrested or convicted of breaking the law 5 times or more, and 3 of those must be felonies. The measures would keep the offenders in custody for up to 21 days and then release them on electronic monitoring. Prosecutors would have 45 days instead of 21 to prepare for a trial or work out a plea deal. Kids would be kept in custody after being found guilty instead of going home. Grant says about 400 kids would be impacted at a cost of nearly $6 million to the Department of Juvenile Justice.
It addresses concerns about recidivisms where, in many cases, members, some of these serious juvenile offenders are actually being sent by us in the criminal justice system back into the very environment that was the problem. So there isn't a bed for them, there isn't a place where we can get them to begin a treatment, rehabilitation process, and instead they're going back into that same environment.
Meanwhile, a separate bill by Senator David Simmons allows judges to sentence someone as a youthful offender if they committed the felony while under the age of 21. Under youthful sentencing guidelines, probation can't exceed 6 years, and time in prison can't be longer than 6 years. Simmons says delays in the judicial system force judges to sentence youth to more time. Bob Dillinger of the Florida Public Defender Association says the measure puts the law back to how it was originally.
We do recognize that youthful offenders can need different treatment, primarily because we do not want them to come back into the system. When there was a delay by sentencing, it took that right away, that privilege of going into additional youthful services, educational and employment services.
Simmons' bill had bipartisan support in committee meetings, but time is running out this session for legislation to pass both chambers. The legislature is scheduled to finish by Friday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
Spurred by a 60 Minutes investigation, the Florida legislature is moving to shut down a cottage industry of shady lawsuits that has grown up around the Americans with Disabilities Act. Jim Ash has that.
Before the House voted 117-0 to approve his bill, Daytona Beach Republican Tom Leake called it a creative way to serve consumers with physical disabilities and business owners worried about lawsuits.
What this law will do will create a voluntary program that promotes accessibility, provides guidance to businesses who need it, and a tool for courts to reject claims for attorney's fees.
Last year, 60 Minutes detailed an explosion of so-called drive-by lawsuits that business owners say amount to little more than a legal shakedown. Plaintiffs claim violations of the Americans with Disability Act and threaten business owners with costly litigation. Leake says it's gotten out of hand.
Drive-by lawsuits have doubled in the last 6 years. There have been 6,000 of these lawsuits filed since 2012. Florida is currently the second in the nation for the proliferation of these lawsuits.
And Leake should know. He's an attorney who's defended business owners against the same kinds of suits.
And so as I'm going through and I'm defending these cases, I'm thinking, well, we've got a problem. The first problem is these businesses aren't coming into compliance voluntarily. And the second problem is we've got these lawsuits that are putting them out of business.
Leake's solution is to order the State Department of Business and Professional Regulation to create a voluntary program. Certified experts would inspect a business, identify the problems, and help the owner come into compliance. Participants can expand their customer base and avoid expensive litigation at the same time. Disability rights advocate J.R. Harding of Tallahassee supports the legislation.
Government should always lead by example. And as our community continues to age, the need for more accessible environments, both electronically and physically, is going to increase.
Harding, who uses a wheelchair, heads the not-for-profit Florida Alliance for Assistive Technology and Services. He says bill sponsors deserve credit for encouraging more businesses to comply with the ADA. But when pressed, Harding acknowledges there's much more policymakers could be doing.
The code is a minimum standard. So I would ask you, is minimum an acceptable standard for your home, for your grandkids, right? No. Okay, that's what gets the disabled community frustrated.
Sunrise Democratic Representative Katie Edwards says she co-sponsored the bill to show that good ideas transcend partisan politics.
It's a good example of what strong public policy can look like, with Republican and Democrats fighting towards a unified issue, making a positive impact for all Floridians.
And Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association General Counsel Richard Turner says the bill could level the playing field for mom and pops.
Number one is they provide a resource for businesses. And I'm not talking about the national chains. I'm talking about the small business person who may not have the money or the staff to research every single federal and state law there is.
Earlier this week, the Senate unanimously agreed with the House, sending the legislation off to Governor Rick Scott for almost certain approval. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
According to state law and conventional wisdom, sunshine is the best disinfectant for political corruption. Florida lawmakers agreed today. Kate Payne reports the House blocked a plan to let local officials keep some of their meetings in the dark.
Florida's sunshine laws require government meetings to be noticed and open to the public. It's part of protecting voters' access to their elected representatives. But the laws can make it difficult for Tallahassee City Commissioner Gil Ziffer to be friends with his colleagues.
I think that's one of the things that helps us work more collegially. If we're friends and if we can have that kind of a friendship, I think it probably helps us when we work together in the dais.
The strict rules mean local officials can't interact like regular coworkers. Republican Blaise Ingolia represents parts of Hernando County. He says because they can't pick up the phone and talk shop with their colleagues, officials may rely on staff or lobbyists instead.
Part of the situations is we have power brokers behind the scenes, we have administrators, we have staff, which are basically driving the train with a lot of these county governments. And there's no way to keep staff honest.
Naples Republican Representative Byron Donald says hours-long public meetings may be transparent, but they're not efficient.
And to notice a meeting for everybody to come together makes the assumption that local officials have nothing else to do with their time except be local officials. We all know that they have other things to do with their time, whether that's run their businesses, do the other service that they have to their community.
All of these complaints are spurring lawmakers to reevaluate the law. Donald says the current system treats all officials like they're corrupt.
To say that they can't pick up the phone and simply say, what's going on in this issue? I heard this. What did you hear? That somehow means that they are now going to be in a smoke-filled room.
Donald's filed a bill to let local officials meet one-on-one, outside of the public eye. But House lawmakers rejected the measure Tuesday. Barbara Peterson is with Florida's First Amendment Foundation. She says the Sunshine Laws protect the public's access to their representatives.
So we have a right, a constitutional right of oversight, and we have the need to hold our government accountable.
There were some restrictions in the bill. Officials wouldn't be able to take votes or talk about publicly funded projects. But that didn't satisfy critics like Peterson.
Those safeguards are virtually meaningless if there's no record of what occurred.
Coconut Creek Democratic Representative Kristen Jacobs served in local government for 16 years. She says coming to the table with questions makes for a better process.
I firmly believe that the kind of spirited debate that takes place in view of the sunshine yields a much healthier outcome than when the deal is already decided before you get there.
And I would local officials can get feedback from staff and citizens and hash out policy details in public workshops. Commissioner Ziffer admits it may not be the most efficient way, but he doesn't want to lose voter input or risk corruption because the process is inconvenient.
I still think it's better for us to have conversations about things in an open setting, in a public setting. So that there's no question about what our motives are and what we're talking about.
The bill failed to win the necessary support of two-thirds of the chamber. A similar measure in the Senate has not had a single hearing, meaning the plan is likely dead for this session. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, Governor Rick Scott has signed the Keys to Independence Act into law. Again, years ago, he signed the measure into law that created the pilot program. Now, as Sasha Cordner reports, Scott's approval this week now makes the program permanent to make it easier for Florida's foster kids to obtain driver's licenses.
I'm a freshman. I attend Pace School for Girls. I live in a group home, and I've been in foster care most of my life.
Monier Randall is currently enrolled in the Keys to Independence program, started in 2014. And thanks to the pilot program, the 15-year-old just received her permit and is on the path to getting her driver's license. That program not only helps cover costs of driver's education, but also helps provide auto insurance.
When I turn 18, I will need my driver's license. I can't just ask my mom to pick me up and take me to a doctor's appointment or to college and things like that because I don't have my mother in my life or no one will teach me how to drive.
And Randall says she's grateful she'll now see the added benefits as the pilot originally scheduled to end this year is now permanent.
I am very excited to learn how to drive and it just makes me feel like a normal kid.
That sense of normalcy has been the driving force of the bill, making Keys to Independence program permanent, says Stewart Republican Representative Gail Harrell, who co-sponsored the measure.
What's more important to a kid than his driver's license? To be able to go out and drive a car. What a liberation, what a rite of passage for every teenager out there. And kids in foster care so many times are deprived of those normal everyday experiences that your kids and my kids just look forward to and love. It's a motivational factor for kids to do well in school so that they can do this. It means so very much.
Having seen the pilot program in action, Lauderdale Lakes Democratic Representative Patricia Williams also likes the new law.
I, for one, am a foster parent, and I was able to see this program at work. And I want to let you know that my first foster child was so excited for me to be able to walk in with her, for her to actually receive her driver's license.
It's also a big priority for Alan Abramowitz, the executive director of Florida's Guardian Ad Litem program.
And over 1,200 children between 15 and 18 now have been part of the Keys to Independence Act where they're learning how to drive. It helps the youth, according to the youth who talk about it, be able to finish high school, get jobs and vocational training, stay in the same school after changing placements, live independently and participate in extracurricular activity. It's been a big success. We've made some changes to expand it, not just to licensed care, but all out-of-home care, including relative care.
And in a statement, Governor Rick Scott says he signed the bill into law because it continues the state's efforts to help foster care kids, quote, thrive and live their dreams. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Kordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And please join us each weeknight at this time throughout the 2017 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.